From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Margaret Fuller just may be the most important American woman to have slipped the modern American mind. Long before the Civil War, when the country was very young and Abe Lincoln was still a country lawyer, Margaret Fuller was writing compellingly about women's rights, abolition, social reform, and war. Her pals were the great transcendentalists, Thoreau, Emerson, and more. They lived lives of the mind. She lived her ideas in a vivid, adventurous life of travel, witness, and reporting, a tireless conversation with the world. This hour on Point, the remarkable life of Margaret Fuller. You can join the conversation. Do you know this woman, this great free thinker? Does she inspire you today? Can you imagine what it took to live this life in 1830, 1840? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Megan Marshall. She teaches narrative nonfiction writing in the MFA program at Emerson College, was a runner-up for the Pulitzer for her book The Peabody Sisters. She's just out with a new book, a great read, getting rave reviews. It's called Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Megan Marshall, it is wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What a woman this is, and so very early. I mean, where did she come from with this free thinking in the midst of a country still so young, so far from anything we think about as liberated women, generally?
Well, that's the question we have to ask. Part of it is simply she was born with this phenomenal energy. And then she had a father who insisted on educating her as if she were a boy. So she was learning Latin at age six. She was translating the Aeneid at age eight. She just happened to take to this education as a brilliant mind. But she saw the inequities in men's and women's lives. She didn't want to be told that she had a boy's mind or a man's mind. And she put that mind to analyzing gender relations, analyzing the world she saw around her, and making her way into that very extraordinary transcendentalist group with Emerson and Thoreau.
Margaret Fuller, 1810 to 1850, an untimely early death, just off the shore of the United States, returning from Europe. We'll look at that. Only 40 years old when she died. A man's ambition with a woman's heart, she wrote in her journal.
Yes.
Once. 'Tis an accursed lot. Remind us, take us back to that this period. We're talking between 1810 and 1850. And, you know, I think for many Americans, it's hard to picture exactly what a woman's place was at that time, nationally and in her New England corner, Boston and Cambridge.
Yeah, yeah.
And how the role that she aspired to, how it contrasted with that of most women of her day.
Cambridge was a place of vibrant minds, but no women could go to college there. There were no women's colleges at all. If a woman married, she became the possession of her husband. She forfeited all her property rights, and even her children were the property of her husband, were they to get divorced. Margaret Fuller had the mind of a man. She couldn't go to college. How was she going to assert herself into this world? She wished she could be a public speaker. This was one of her great talents, mm-hmm. conversation and dispute, debate. She could best all the men that she knew, and she was very friendly with the brilliant minds. But what she ended up doing was becoming a writer. That was a place she could make herself heard. What she attended to in her writing was also unusual. She wasn't going to write sentimental novels. She mm-hmm. she made herself a journalist, a critique of gender roles, a critic of gender roles, and then, as you said, went on to Europe, became a foreign correspondent, the only woman,
The first American woman
yes.
foreign correspondent, I think is fair to say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean,
and then
you've got her running ahead here of Henry James and Edith Wharton and Mary
exactly.
Cassatt and John Reed and Ernest Hemingway. There's Margaret Fuller.
Yes, yep. She saw New England was too small for her. First, she stopped at New York, where she was a pioneering journalist. You might say she began the new journalism there, going to
page one opinion columnist for Horace Greeley's
New York Tribune.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. And she went to the tomb. She went to the mentalist asylum. She was very concerned about the new urban poor, the Irish immigrants. She wrote about these issues, a potential for blacks to vote in New York State. That came up. She advocated for that in the paper. But even this was not enough for her. She wanted to go to Europe. She had, as I said, studied the classics. The Roman Republic of the old days was a great ideal for her. Mm-hmm. She landed in Europe in 1848 during the Year of Revolutions.
Not exactly a time of library research, a time of fire in the streets.
Exactly. And she joined in that revolution, too, became a nurse in the hospitals in revolutionary Rome, even as she was writing about it.
There's so much to look at here. Margaret Fuller writing that she realized intellectually and emotionally she would have to learn, because of women's position at that time, as she wrote, to be my own priest, pupil, parent, child, husband, and wife. She was a big, broad, free thinker.
Yes, indeed. You know, that quotation comes up at a time when her father had died. She'd had a relatively prosperous upbringing, but when her father died, they realized that they actually had no income. So she was left to support her six siblings and her mother. She was age 25. She began to teach. She began to then hold these really extraordinary conversations for women, which mm-hmm. you might call the first consciousness-raising groups in the U.S. This is 1839, 1840. Mm-hmm. And she asked these women to consider, what were we born to do and how shall we do it? They were examining the Greek myths and Roman myths that most women were not raised learning, because they didn't learn Latin and Greek. She was going to teach this to them. But she wanted women to empower themselves based on what they were learning about these great women of the past.
Her father was a U.S. congressman from Massachusetts, and then Speaker of, I think it was the House.
Yes, in Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Later sort of fell out of out of the groove and went back to farming.
Yes.
She, after his death, as you write, remind us, went off to teach, and that began to bring her into the realm of the transcendentalists. Emerson, Thoreau, and Moore. Describe that connection, that weave.
Well, around late 1830s, Emerson began publishing his work Nature, which was really the first expression of this sense of there was a higher soul that was – we were all unified through it and part of it through nature. She was drawn to this. But he was a rebel too. He'd been a minister in Boston, and when he was impatient with the ceremonies like communion, he wanted to set this aside. He had to leave his church. And so she was attracted to these rebel ministers because she was such a rebel at heart. But she was challenging them all the time. She challenged them particularly on the subject of women. What could women's role be in the world?
How did she come into their circle, Emerson, Thoreau, and so on? Did she seek them out? Did they seek her out? Was it through Alcott, I think, who was running the school?
Well, she taught for a while in Bronson Alcott's school. Also, Elizabeth Peabody, who I wrote about in my mm-hmm. previous book, was mm-hmm. a great sort of intellectual impresario, and she was actually the one who brokered the meeting with Emerson. But this whole group of people, Emerson, Thoreau, Alcott, Fuller, they really were so intent on conversation and self-education. They become impatient with Harvard, the stodgy curriculum. They even thought of starting a new college in Concord that you could pay as you go, and they would just give lectures to each other and to the young people. They were always looking for what they called the newness, the new young people, the new ideas. And Fuller actually edited a journal in which Thoreau's first writings were published.
This was The Dial.
Mm-hmm. beginning in 1840. And, you know, I think you would say this is the most influential literary journal in probably 19th century America because of the people.
So she edited Ralph Waldo Emerson. Edited Henry David Thoreau.
Yes. She rejected Thoreau's first essay that he turned in, The Service. It wasn't really published until much later in his life.
Was it strange for them at that time to be edited by a woman, Margaret Fuller?
It was. You know, it was interesting. It just shows how they didn't actually see her as a conventional woman in a certain way. She was just a being, and she was a great mind, and she could, Emerson took her criticism and he changed his work. And then when it turned out she wasn't making any money as an editor, she resigned that editorship. Emerson took it over, and then he was editing Fuller. It was on his watch that she published her first great feminist essay called The Great Lawsuit that led to her book Woman in the 19th Century, in which she's writing things like, we would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man. This was her great
talk about ahead of
heart.
Your time.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe a mind like Emerson's could take that on board, or maybe Thoreau What did ordinary citizens around her think of that kind of the writing in 1845?
And one of the things she went at was marriage. She considered marriage to be a corrupt contract in most cases, but she
Of the inequity in it.
Yes, yeah, and she saw that most women were subdued and submissive in marriage, and her big argument was for a fullness of being of both men and women. So she thought it not only was bad for women, but also for men, although men were the empowered ones in marriages. So she laid out a series of marriages that she thought might be ideal ones, kind of in ascending order from simply partnership to working as professional equals to a kind of spiritual conjoint journey that the highest type of marriage. But the average married woman didn't want to be hearing that she was living in slavery, in effect. This is what Margaret Fuller said. You know, women are as slaves in marriage. And this book was very controversial, even as it just flew off the shelves.
I'm blown away by her thinking in this time frame, when people are still sort of, you know, striding out into the prairies and settling sod huts and log cabins. She's back there doing all this, not marrying herself in the United States, maybe, I guess, marrying later in Italy, though that's kind of confusing in the midst of everything that went on there. It is an amazing, amazing story. Megan Marshall is with us, author of the big, new, wonderful biography, Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. Lita writes to us, an amazing woman who, like so many amazing women of that time, is unknown. Well, I mean, it's not as though it's the first biography, but it's a very vivid one, and somehow her name doesn't walk with so many others these days. NJ writes, Buckminster Fuller, a personal hero of mine, was a grand-nephew of Margaret, and I haven't learned much about her. It appears genes may be responsible for her deep thinking, maybe a family trait. How do you account for where this ball of fire came from, Megan Marshall?
Well, I think there's something in that. You know, her father was a brilliant man, but he wasn't really of the transcendental mindset. So I think she was always a little bit on the outside looking in and very much able to critique. As I said, she was given this lawyer's view of the world, always disputing. And that's why her first feminist work...
With her sort of Socratic education.
Yes, and her first feminist work was phrased as the great lawsuit, man versus men, woman versus women. How can the individual man, the individual woman stand up against societal constraints?
Let's hear a little bit. That then evolved into Women in the 19th Century, her 1845 book. And she writes at a depth that you say sort of, before Simone de Beauvoir, Virginia Woolf, she's really getting down to the essence of gender here. Could you read for us something from Woman in the 19th Century?
Sure. Here she says, it is no more the order of nature that the feminine should be incarnated pure in any form than that the masculine energy should exist unmingled with it in any form. Male and female represent the two sides of the great radical dualism. But, in fact, they are perpetually passing into one another. Fluid hardens to solid. Solid rushes to fluid. There's no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman. History jeers at the attempts of physiologists to bind great original laws by the forms which flow from them. They make a rule. They say from observation what can and cannot be. In vain. Nature provides exceptions to every rule. She sends women to battle and sets Hercules spinning. She enables women to bear immense burdens, cold and frost. She enables the man who feels maternal love to nourish his infant like a mother.
Megan Marshall reading from Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century. Now, maybe we only think this as a sort of modern-sounding insight, that each gender has within it elements of the other. Or maybe this is ancient. Did everybody understand this? Or was this seen as, oh, my God, how can she write that?
Well, yes. How could she write this? I mean, this was the time when women and men were really separating into separate spheres. You hear that phrase a lot from historians of the time. And, you know, men were in their smoking rooms, women were in the kitchen or in the parlor. You know, each had their own issues, and never the twain shall meet for maybe decades. But here, Fuller was, I think because she had the sense of a kind of masculine mind but a feminine self, she was not going to have this. And, you know, if you look at the men of the time, too, Emerson, Thoreau, Alcott, they weren't conventional men either. And I think she saw that, too. I mean, Emerson stayed at home and wrote in his study, and he mm-hmm. had his son playing on the floor of his office while he was writing. So these weren't simple lives. They were complex lives, and she really firmly believed that all people, men and women, should be able to experience what she said, a fullness of being. Human beings are not so constituted that they can live without expansion, and if they do not get it one way, must another or perish.
An incredible, almost explosively free mind. There is no holy masculine man, no purely feminine woman, she wrote, as Megan was just reading there. And as you say, anticipating Virginia Woolf's explorations of male and female character in fiction. Margaret Fuller is our subject. Let's go to our callers. Nancy in Lexington, Kentucky. You're on with Megan Marshall. Thank you for calling, Nancy.
Thank you. I wondered if she read Mary Wollstonecraft. I may have some time sequence wrong there, but Mary Wollstonecraft's claim that women are children, I wondered if she read her.
Yes, definitely. She read Mary Wollstonecraft and took her as a great model. Even, I think we can see when we talk about it later, her explosively controversial personal life, she followed after Mary Wollstonecraft in that. But interestingly, her father, Margaret's father, who was educating her as a boy, provided a copy of Vindication of the Rights of Woman, both to Margaret and her mother.
Remind us all of Mary Wollstonecraft,
yes.
A personal heroine, as you tell us,
you know,
of Margaret Fuller, but much earlier.
Yes, yeah. She was active during the French Revolution. She mm-hmm. was a British writer, but she took herself over to the French Revolution mm-hmm. to write about that and was inspired to write this great book, The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which sets up some of these arguments that Margaret Fuller later draws on. Fuller, I would say, was more a psychologist of gender roles, whereas Wollstonecraft was simply, you know, educator ourselves, and women need more education in order to put themselves on an equal footing with men. But I think Margaret was starting from there and going far forward.
Nancy mentions Wollstonecraft speaking of women as children. I don't know Wollstonecraft well enough to know what she's referring to.
Well, women
to.
Are
that,
children.
That doesn't sound proto-feminist.
Yes, but women are as children in marriage. They are no better than the children that their husbands own. And that was a point that Margaret Fuller also made.
I see. And so here's
they're
a personal.
Infantilized.
Was there a sense of a movement? I mean, some people have talked about Margaret Fuller as the first American feminist. Does she merit that? Not that it even matters, but how do you look at that, Claire?
Well, you know, she was in Europe in 1848 when the Seneca Falls Convention was held, the first women's rights convention. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't able to attend, but she was coming back from Europe in 1850 when the first major international convention was to be held in Worcester, Massachusetts. And people expected her to be there and to lead that convention. Mm-hmm. She was very much, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton had actually attended.
Before
some
her
of the,
ship went down off of
yes.
Long Island,
yes.
Fire Island.
So, in fact, they held a moment of silence for Fuller at that first meeting. It was very moving.
Does she deserve the claim, even not being there? Was she writing
it? Yes, because you can see, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was there at mm-hmm. her conversations, and she was very much invoked at these conventions, the Women's Rights Convention. In fact, not just her feminism, but the spirit of revolution that came through in her dispatches from Europe during 1848 and 49. The rhetoric of the women's movement was very much influenced by that, but they also learned from it. They said, we need to be better organized than those revolutionaries were in Italy that they had learned about from Margaret Fuller. We need to get this happening. But I think you can see a similar progression from the anti-slavery rhetoric that you do, say, in the 60s, 1960s in the U.S., the civil rights rhetoric led to a women's movement here in the 70s, just as the anti-slavery rhetoric of the 1830s and 40s led to a women's rights revolution. You know, all people must be free. Margaret Fuller made a daring statement, women are as slaves in marriage, and that, you know, really picked up on those who were very concerned about the rights of man. Now let's go to the rights of women, too.
We'll look at her experience of that revolutionary fervor mm-hmm. and how, in a way, her celebration of it brought that back into a long American chain of events that you can see maybe right up through the civil rights movement and beyond, thanks to Margaret Fuller. I'm really interested in her sense of this country. I mean, she knew this country and Europe. She
yes.
made that European sort of tour move before. There were many who came after her, as you say, who did that from, you know, Henry James right through Hemingway. There she was early. She writes about America as this place where life rushes wide and free. But she made a visit to what was then something like the frontier out in the what's now the Midwest. How old was she when she went? What did she take from that?
She was 33 years old. She had just put aside editing The Dial, and she viewed this something as a vacation, but, you know, a journalist is never on vacation. So she had her pencil in hand and traveled through Niagara, down the rivers into what she called the Lake District of
America, the Great Lakes.
So she was in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and she was there at a time, she said, it'll never again be like this. She was seeing the great virgin forest being laid waste.
Chicago was only 8,000 people when she was there. I mean, this was the frontier in many ways.
It was. And there were people in sod huts, and there were one of the things she was most interested to see and experience was what was happening with the Native Americans then. She went to a gathering of the tribes on Mackinac Island. She walked among these many gathered peoples who were there to receive reimbursements from their land, of course.
This what was the federal
blankets
government at that time.
And she showed them how her parasol worked, and they showed her how they were grinding corn. It was a
you described fleets of canoes coming in for this meeting for the disbursement of the federal grant or whatever it was at that time.
But she saw just really how terribly sad it was. But she was one of the few, I think, who could see that the Indians had a great culture of their own, worth and civility of their own.
We have Little Eagle calling from Hannibal, Missouri. Little Eagle, you're on the air with Megan Marshall.
Hi, Megan. I just want to say my great-grandfather had a line in his private diary. You know, he disappeared from our reservation in South Dakota for about 30 years. And one line says, "Met Margaret, Miss Margaret Fuller, a woman of truth and fire," and that's that prompted me to look her up, and I did many years ago, and I came across something by John Madison, I think it was.
Yes.
Read about her, and you know, I'm it's just this particular woman. We call her the Nagatawita, the flow of being, you know. And the only other woman that comes close to her as far as, you know, understanding the this being flow concept, somebody called Flannery O'Connor.
Little Eagle, if I might ask you, you said South Dakota, and we see your name. Does it make you Sioux, or what Native American?
Yes, I'm Unkpapa Sioux, yeah.
Wow. And so
my great-grandfather learned to read and write, and the day he could put things into his journal, he just went around the country with a woman that he met in Nebraska, and they traveled the land for 30 years, you know.
And somewhere crossed paths with Margaret Fuller. That's just amazing. And recognized all that in her? So immediately, Little Eagle, it's wonderful of you to call. Thank you very much for calling in from Hannibal. I think that merits a reading of some kind. But set up for us, she saw Native Americans in the plains, the prairie states, when their time was passing, but they were still there looking on the Europeans who were coming in. How was her perception of them different from many of her contemporaries?
Well, I think I could read this passage that will...
Sure. This is from something she wrote, Summer on the Lakes, and she means the Great Lakes there.
Yes. Yeah,
this is where she's talking about one of these European settlers talking to her, describing an interaction with a Native American to her.
She says, "On the shore of Lake Namabin," this is in Wisconsin, "had formerly been one of the finest Indian villages. Our host said that one day, as he was lying there beneath the bank, he saw a tall Indian standing at gaze on the knoll. He lay a long time, curious to see how long the figure would maintain its statue-like absorption. But at last his patience yielded, and in moving he made a slight noise. The Indian saw him, gave a wild, snorting sound of indignation and pain, and strode away. What feelings must consume their hearts at such moments? I scarcely see how they can forbear to shoot the white man where he stands. This gentleman, though, in other respects of most kindly and liberal heart, showed the aversion that the white man soon learns to feel for the Indian on whom he encroaches, the aversion of the injurer for him he has degraded. After telling the anecdote of his seeing the Indian gazing at the seat of his former home, which one would think would have awakened soft compassion, almost remorse, in the present owner of that fair hill, which contained for the exile the bones of his dead, the ashes of his hopes, he observed instead, "They cannot be prevented from straggling back here to their old haunts. I wish they could. They ought not to be permitted to drive away our game." Our game? Just heavens!
Margaret Fuller writing there. We hear her in this description of the settler's observation of the Native American, projecting a perspective here, but put into words, how would you describe
it? To me, it's so astonishing that she, first of all, she's feeling very much for the Indian who's come back to see his lands, and how just absolutely worse than unfair that is. How, and then she understands also this kind of prejudice, and I wouldn't say understands, but she's analyzing the prejudice that develops. She says in the injurer,
the settler for admires,
whom
but then immediately,
mm-hmm. yes, yeah,
says our game, the settler's game,
yeah, and how she sees how, as I said, I think it's part of, she's always able to just kind of stand back from what was going on around her and see how this prejudice developed, and the absolute infuriating wrongness of it. And this is what she brought to American readers in her book about her summer trip to the lakes. Summer on the Lakes, is it's mm-hmm. called. And really, you think about this, is 1844. It was published well before Thoreau went out to his cabin and wrote about Walden. She's writing about the destruction of the forest. And the worst thing, I think, that she saw was the Native Americans who were made to cut down their trees and feed them to the steamboats so that these intruding Europeans
could
come.
To further extend the intrusion.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it makes me wonder again about how she was seen in those years, because her brilliance is unmistakable, but the freedom of her thought must have been magnetic to some and repellent to others.
Exactly. And her, just in person, she could be even disturbing
sort of
to people.
Overwhelming.
Yes, overwhelming. I think that's what you would say.
In her intellect, in her passion, both?
Yes. And, she had a great craving to have a meeting of the minds. And some people just didn't have it, weren't up for it. So she could actually turn against you or turn aside, but she also had a great need to connect. And Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was perhaps her greatest friend in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Both benefited and suffered from this. You know, when she died so sadly, he said, "I've lost in her my audience." Margaret Fuller was his ideal foil. But when they were too close, he tended to get skittish.
This great line from Emerson describing what it felt like to talk with your subject, Margaret Fuller. He said, "It was like being set in a large place. You stretch your limbs and dilate to your utmost size." What a conversation partner.
Yes.
She must have been incredible. Megan Marshall's new biography is Margaret Fuller, A New American Life, Trailblazing Proto-Feminist Transcendentalist Adventurer. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's trailblazing proto-feminist, transcendentalist, adventurer, Margaret Fuller, visionary social critic and thinker at the dawn of the American era, lived from 1810 to 1850, died tragically early at 40 in a shipwreck just off of Fire Island, just off the American coast, coming home from Europe. Nathaniel Hawthorne was sent out to look for her things, hoping they were washed ashore.
Thoreau,
if I got that?
Thoreau,
excuse me.
Yeah.
Thoreau, that's right, for her things. Megan Marshall is a big new biography of her called Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. Emily is calling from Berlin, Massachusetts. Emily, thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you. My memory is not as fresh as I would like it, but when I read Margaret Fuller's book about these women, I came away with a sense of her great naivety in that the models she proposed for imitation were drawn from her reading and from literature. And I particularly remember her citing Antigone as a model, as an icon of female independence and courage. And she seems to forget that Antigone is a fictional character created by men, by the playwright Sophocles. And some of the other characters she raises for our admiration are similarly fictional.
Emily, where else might a woman have looked in 1830 or 40?
Well, exactly, but that doesn't obscure the fact that her arguments are naively drawn. She takes these characters from the great literary past in the classics as though they had a historic existence.
It's a very interesting point. Of course, she was a woman steeped in the classics, but Megan, how do you respond to
that? I think, Tom, you're right that she was looking for role models in fiction as much as in real life. I mean, she set up George Sand and Mary Wollstonecraft also, and the Queens of England. And in Woman in the 19th Century, there are a couple of marriages that she points to of kind of spiritual reformers that are actual real people. But I think she really felt that we needed to embody these the heroic traits of the Greek gods and goddesses, of the great heroines of fiction in
Did
order
you see
to
that
move
as
forward.
Naivete?
I don't personally see that as naivete. I see that as a kind of creativity, a kind of looking for whatever source you can find for power.
Working with what she had. A listener writes that became familiar with Fuller in the 80s. A friend of hers, Kel Braverman, had a play at the Berkeley Rep called The Margaret Ghost. Our listener says, I wept for her, Margaret Fuller, to be a brilliant woman entrapped in a patriarchal culture in which she fought for a place was difficult indeed. And to be in unrequited love with Emerson must have worsened things, too. What about that relationship with Emerson?
You know, there's a lot of talk about the Emerson-Fuller relationship. I don't see it as unrequited love. I see it as unrequited friendship.
In both ways. Failed to
you know, that's the way I see it. They were sparring all the time, and there's some great
moments.
Were
they lovers or just transcendental spiritual lovers? Or
you know, I found out a lot of great stuff about this. They did attempt to have a kind of platonic constellation of lovers. They actually used that word amongst Margaret Fuller, Emerson, and some younger people.
To be a group
who would be committed to each other and committed to conversation and to furthering their spiritual lives. But, you know,
At a plane beyond romantic love, I guess.
Yes, Emerson was somewhat unhappily married.
So we wonder.
So he liked this idea too. But I think really it was the two of them trying to connect. Emerson, in a way, looking for a brother in Fuller. Fuller looking for a sister in Emerson. And you know, much as we might say that there's no holy masculine man and no holy feminine woman, they really couldn't get their femininities and masculinities out of the way. And I think this is one of the reasons she left New England and went to New York to work as the front page columnist for Greeley's New York Tribune. She began to see that her sphere socially was going to be limited to this kind of frustrating friendship with Emerson. I don't think she was in love with him at all, but she wanted him to be her answering soul, her soulmate. And
what a foil or partner, or call it mate, soulmate, call it what you will. Billy in Peoria, Illinois. Billy, you're on the air with Megan Marshall. Thanks for calling.
Howdy, Tom.
Howdy.
Just listening to you folks talk, what an incredible person. And I've read Emerson and I've read Thoreau, but I've never heard of her. And I'm curious, why is she not mentioned in education? And my mother-in-law, when you're talking about settling the West, she used to say that when the West was settled, the frontier, it was great for men and dogs.
Men and dogs. Women not in that formulation.
Fuller said that, too.
Hard on women and horses.
It's one of the things she noticed right out there was how hard it was for the women and how unsuited they were for this life and how many of them were following their husbands. Just yet another example of the corrupt contract that she saw as marriage, although she was not obviously opposed to women doing whatever it was they might want to do. If that was going west, fine. But I think it's wonderful what you say about the
Wonderful for Men and Dogs, The Frontier.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she went out. She saw it. She came back. She went to New York. She went on to Europe. And I love something. Billy, thank you for your observation. I love something so deeply democratic. Maybe it's transcendentalist in her view. You write about her maintaining that all human beings are capable of great accomplishment, that genius would be, quoting her here, common as light if men trusted their highest selves. And I assume she included women in that use of men.
Indeed.
But that from an early age, she said, I felt I was not born to the common womanly lot. And yet, there were those restraints and constraints. She's sort of above them very often.
Yeah, and I think by saying that, not born to the common womanly lot, I think that meant that she saw herself also as a potential heroine, that she could speak for women. I mean, she was criticized for analyzing marriage while not being married, but she actually felt she could have a perspective on that from the outside.
Susan in Charlotte, North Carolina is calling. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I am familiar. I'm an acting teacher here in Charlotte, and I use a book called Spoon River Anthology.
Of course. Edgar Lee Masters.
A series of monologues by people who have already died. It's as if you're reading the epitaph that's mm-hmm. written by the person after they've died. And there is a character named Margaret Fuller Slack, and I was wondering if that character was based on Margaret Fuller, because she discusses in her epitaph how, in discussing sex and sexuality, she talks about then there was the age-old question, should it be marriage, celibacy, or unchastity? Mm. And she talks about how she ruined her life by marrying this man because she wanted to be able to have sex, mm-hmm. but she didn't want to have to deal with unchastity. And the last line of the monologue is, hear this, ambitious souls, sex is the curse of life. And I was just wondering if perhaps your guest knew if this was a character that was based on the actual...
Well, what a brilliant...
Susan, this is great. Play stump the biographer.
Yeah, no, this is a brilliant reading. You know, I think in the end, Fuller would not have said that sex was... was to be avoided or a problem in life, because she did ultimately succumb, kind of gloriously so. But there was quite a phenomenon of Margaret Fuller passion after her death, and there were clubs set up all over, often in the Midwest, so this is why the Spoon River Anthology might fit in with mm-hmm. that.
Of course.
Margaret Fuller clubs, where women gathered and read and discussed and presented papers to each other, and it's quite likely that this was that children were named Margaret Fuller after Margaret Fuller. So I think this is a perfect example of that. I just wanted to say a brief thing about why is Fuller's work not known mm-hmm. when Emerson's and Thoreau's was. Mm-hmm. You know, Fuller was a great heroine of the women's movement and of the suffrage movement, but when women got the vote, there was a kind of turning against those radical women. It was the same time that the canon of English literature, American literature, was being set up. And mm-hmm. I think Fuller's work, which wasn't really like Emerson's essays, it wasn't really like Thoreau's Walden, it was journalism, it was advocacy, it was psychology. There was no place to fit that into the American studies curriculum or the American literature curriculum. And she kind of fell out. You know, you'll find her mentioned in textbooks, and actually now, I think if you were to go to college now, you'd find Margaret Fuller on probably most literature curricula, but not, you know, when we were growing up.
Susan, thank you so much for turning on that Spoon River Anthology light there. That's wonderful. And then, of course, there's the great image of Thoreau on the beach.
Yes.
She comes back from Europe. Well, let's pause on, and he's looking for a lost manuscript that she's thought to have had or rumored, or what was he looking for that was never found?
Yes. Well, she'd been in Rome during the siege, the first wave of the Risorgimento.
This is Garibaldi.
Garibaldi and Mazzini, who was kind of the intellectual leader of both of these great minds and revolutionaries.
Time of ferment and revolution, you know, all over Europe, Italy in particular.
And this really made her think sort of differently about Emerson, who could, you know, sit in his house and write about being, you know, self-reliant. But what was he really doing? You know, mm-hmm. these were active, self-reliant men who were working for a cause. She really saw that difference. And she had been writing these dispatches home, but all the time also keeping notes, writing a manuscript.
She found a lover there at last.
Yes, she
was.
Giovanni Assoli, who
younger man,
10 years younger. Mm-hmm. She was in her late 30s. He was in his late 20s. Mm-hmm. He was an Italian member of the Civic Guard, which turned into sort of the Revolutionary Guard. And she kind of lost her way in it was Easter week, Vespers service in St. Peter's, and she lost her way. And this man comes up and takes her by the elbow, and seemed to have been love on both parts.
She has
instantly
a son by him, finds her ways to the glories, her way to the glory of sexuality with him.
Yes.
Writes about that in kind of muted but not so invisible terms.
You can even see it in these dispatches. She's saying, our hopes are swelling for the Republic. Then she's in seclusion. She withdraws for 6 months. She can't eat. She can't, and then there's this great flowering of revolution and of this son for whom she has such great emotion. She ends up leaving him. He was born in secret because both she couldn't reveal this tie, nor could her lover Giovanni, who was a Roman Catholic. He couldn't marry her, or it appeared that he couldn't. He had a family fortune.
Did they marry? Did they not? Do we know?
I think it's pretty certain that they did, but it was also quite clear that they weren't married when this child was conceived, mm-hmm. and in the passionate early days of their romance. And I don't think she particularly had imagined staying with him necessarily.
But she was coming back with him to the United States in 1850 on the boat. The ship was the Elizabeth with their son, I guess, as well.
Yes.
They're only 300 yards off Fire Island. What happened?
Well, what happened, the bad things began to happen just as they were leaving Italy, and the captain, the wonderful captain, died of smallpox. So then the first mate is piloting this ship, and they get across the Atlantic. A storm blows up, and he's not sure exactly where they are. He mistakes where they are. So they had gone past New York. They were trying to land in New York Harbor, and it's the middle of the night. The storm blows up, and they hit a sandbar off of Fire Island, and this whole ship comes to the ground and is foundered. It begins to break up. As dawn comes, they see people on shore 300 yards off, and they think, well, we're going to be rescued. Mm-hmm. And, nobody's
didn't
coming.
Happen.
So the crew, this was actually not a passenger ship. It was a cargo ship. Mm-hmm. Fuller didn't have money to come back on the Cunard steamer line. So this is a sailing ship, even in 1850. And she couldn't swim. She didn't want to leave her husband and her son. So a number of people in the crew managed to struggle to shore or to drag the widow of the captain's to shore.
But not Fuller,
She was in a way dying as these dramatic heroines did. When you talk about the heroines of fiction, this is really what she had become, kind of a heroine of fiction.
And Emerson dispatches Thoreau to look for her. What did he find?
He found in the end only a button from Giovanni's military jacket, which was so poignant. One of the discoveries in my book was I came across a letter that Emerson had written to the collector of the Port of New York. Thoreau had made a list of the baggage that Fuller was carrying with her, and Emerson was writing to the collector of the Port of New York saying, please, please look for these things, above all this desk that had the manuscript in it.
Never found. January 6th, 1850, she wrote a dispatch number 37 to the New York Tribune, The Next Revolution. Maybe we do have time to read it. She foresaw the era of social upheaval that had begun in Europe but would come to this country for a century. Maybe we just time to read it.
She didn't want this to end. The next revolution here and elsewhere will be radical. Every man who assumes an arbitrary lordship over fellow man must be driven out. It will be an uncompromising revolution. England cannot reason, nor ratify, nor criticize it. France cannot betray it. Germany cannot bungle it. Italy cannot bubble it away. Russia cannot stamp it down nor hide it in Siberia. The new era is no longer an embryo. It is born. It begins to walk. This very year sees its first giant steps and can no longer mistake its features. Men have long been talking of a transition state. It is over. The power of positive, determinate effort is begun. A faith is offered. Men are everywhere embracing it. The film is hourly falling from their eyes, and they see, not only near but far, duties worthy to be done. God be praised.
Margaret,
this is a language that was reaching America in 1850, just as things were heating up here in the anti-slavery movement.
Yes.
You just really have to think how empowering this was to people like even John Brown, who were ready to take arms, that what she had reported about the martyred young men who'd given their lives to the cause of liberation in Rome was just powerfully inspiring.
And that just the beginning. I mean, what a century, and much more later, we'd hear a president in his inaugural talking about Seneca Falls and Stonewall and Selma. I mean, this sort of, not to mention all the other revolutions, this is foresight.
This is where it began, yes.
It's a remarkable story. One only imagines if she had had another 20 or 30 years or a mind like hers out there today, how wonderful.
Yeah. I think that only the suffrage movement would have carried on, I think, her psychological insights. It would not just have been, let's get the vote. It's, let's get women out into the world.
And think about this duality that we throw over gender and the ways in which it is not
still
such an iron cage. Meghan Marshall, it's a wonderful, wonderful, vivid telling of this vivid life. Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for coming in. Listeners, tomorrow, in advance of St. Patrick's Day, we will tell the story of the legendary tall-masted ship, the Jeannie Johnston, that brought thousands of Irish from famine to America. That, a remarkable tale as well. But today, Margaret Fuller, wonderful story. Meghan Marshall, thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.